GM says its stock price will be higher when it goes public.
So does that mean taxpayers are getting a good deal after the bailout?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org for Tuesday, November the 16th. The latest report on TARP says foreclosure document issues could be more than a paper cut for the U.S. economy. Also, teaching business with some Hollywood examples. All that's ahead. But first,
General Motors this morning said its initial stock price will be more than expected. So when it starts trading in New York on Thursday, it'll fetch between $32 and $33 a share. Now, that'll net taxpayers billions of dollars after the government bailed out the troubled Detroit automaker during the financial crisis. Stephen Ratner is the former head of President Obama's auto task force and author of the book Overhaul. He's with us from our New York bureau. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is this a good deal for taxpayers, this $32, $33 a share?
I think it's quite a good deal for taxpayers. It implies, based on where the stock will presumably trade after and so forth, that of the $50 billion total put into GM, taxpayers will recover at least $42, $43 billion, and maybe all $50 billion. Remember that a lot of that money was put in under the Bush administration, under the early Obama days, as kind of a bridge. So I think all things considered, taxpayers are doing incredibly well here.
It looks like a lot of the stock won't be accessible to a lot of taxpayers, though, and their money bailed the company out. Is that fair?
The stock may not be accessible on the initial public offering itself, but it'll start to trade on Thursday morning, and then they can buy it in the open market like everybody else. I am not familiar with exactly how they're allocating shares here, but the idea of essentially having a nationwide offering and saying any taxpayer can buy it, unfortunately, as fair and as equitable as that may sound, the logistics of that would be essentially impossible.
What do you think would have happened had the government not gotten involved?
I think this is one of the most important points for Americans to take away from this whole experience. Whether you like bailouts or not, what you have to understand what the alternative was in this case. If the government had not stepped in and provided this financing, these companies would have closed their doors, they would have laid off every single worker, they would have shut their doors, all their suppliers would have gone out of business. The next thing that would have happened is that Ford would have shut down because it wouldn't have been able to get parts from these suppliers who are now shut down. And you would have had a catastrophe. You would have had a couple of million jobs lost in an instant. And so people who say that there was a third alternative of somehow the government staying out, but these companies reorganizing themselves on their own using private capital was fantasy land. There was no private capital. The markets were frozen.
Stephen Ratner, the former head of the Auto Task Force and author of the book Overhaul. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, more on Chrysler revamping its stock coming up.
The Congressional Oversight Panel that was created to monitor the Wall Street bailout has a new report out this morning. It says all those mortgage documentation issues that led to foreclosure moratoriums at many banks could have severe consequences for the economy. At issue is whether banks followed the proper paperwork procedures when transferring ownership of mortgages and when processing foreclosures. Former Senator Ted Kaufman is a Delaware Democrat who chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel, and he joins us now. Senator, good morning.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy.
So does this problem have the capacity, do you think, to call into question the ownership of tens of billions of dollars worth of mortgages and actually lead to another financial crisis?
Frankly, we don't know yet what the implications would be. What we're calling on Treasury to do to really take a hard look at this. There's a number of different things that could be a major problem. One is due process. The second is the fact that thousands of documents are being signed by people no one knew was really in them. And then we have a major mortgage modification program to try to help people that are having problems, $30 billion program, and we're very concerned that our services, can they really modify what is going on? Are they modifying what's going on with the mortgages? So it's a major concern.
A lot of banks halted foreclosures for a period and then restarted them. Do you think that they were right to restart foreclosures?
That's what Treasury has to find out. We've laid this out. We just think this is important enough that they should start doing some extra special things in addition to just checking. We think they should go to stress tests and really test the banks. They've not done that since 2009 because, look, we could have systemic problems there. People could lose faith in the markets themselves. And finally, we get back to this really important thing, and that is individuals having due process. Now they're not dealing with their local bank. They're dealing with some faceless organization, and Treasury has to look into that.
How long do you think until we know the size and the scope of this problem?
I don't know. I mean, we're working on it. It should be soon. They're drilling down. I know they're drilling down throughout the organization. We have the 50 attorneys general working on this. So I think we'll have something, too. But time is of the essence to get this and get it right and get it right quick.
Former Senator Ted Kaufman, who chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel that oversees the Wall Street bailout, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy, you and I have reported about the Fed pumping another $600 billion into the economy to spur more lending.
Absolutely.
By bringing down long-term interest rates. Well, guess what?
Long-term rates are going up.
They're going up, yeah.
Well, let's get to the bottom of that with our regular Tuesday market analyst, Julie Neiman of Smith Moore & Company. She joins us from St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, why are long-term interest rates rising, and what does that mean for us?
Well, the Fed is only focusing on inflation here, and core prices are actually going down. The problem is inflation is going up in the rest of the world, not Europe, but in the Brazil, Russia, India, and China. You've got inflation 5% and higher out there. Industry's booming, interest rates rising, and investors are buying bonds there to get some higher yield. So with interest rates rising there, you've got the fallout effect.
So inflation means that investors are less interested in the government bonds here. Now, one of the reasons the Fed wanted to bring down long-term rates, Julie, was to get mortgage rates down and spur the housing market. And today we got a report from the Congressional Oversight Panel, and it says all those mortgage documentation issues we've been hearing about could cause a real problem for the financial system. I spoke earlier with the chair of that committee, Senator Ted Kaufman. Here's what he had to say the government should do.
We think they should go to stress tests and really test the banks. They've not done that since 2009 because, look, we could have systemic problems there.
So another test for the banks. Julie, what do you make of that?
Well, you heard it here first. The stress tests were bogus to begin with. They had to look rigorous. Bank accounting income is fictional. They have real loan losses. They don't have to call it a loss until they actually sell the repossessed house. And some of these guys own entire subdivisions. The bad loans aren't being recognized, but at least we assume they knew how to do the paperwork, and obviously they didn't. But secondly, the stress test economic assumptions were just wrong. Unemployment, they said, would not get any worse at 9%. It's really at 19%. And they said real estate prices were stabilized. It's still going down. So you're looking at the government throwing a lot of money at the problem. They didn't tackle the real problem. That's bank reform. Oh, by the way, Europe has the same problem, only worse.
Okay, Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. Thanks.
You bet.
Apple says it's news that people will never forget. That's a longtime holdout is finally going to start selling songs on Apple's iTunes Music Store. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith is with us to talk about what all the chatter is about. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning, Steve.
So don't keep us waiting. Which band are we talking about here?
Well, Steve, it's a band that has a long history with Apple.
You say yes, I say no.
The Beatles.
The Beatles. They've been locked in lawsuits with Apple since 1978 when the band sued Apple over its name and logo.
Now, that's what kept the Beatles out of the world's biggest music store?
Well, that and the fact the Beatles don't really need iTunes. They are the world's best-selling band. Last year, they had the third best-selling album in the U.S. Mm. And EMI, the Beatles record label, makes a lot more money selling CDs than they will selling digital songs.
So, Stacey, if it's not about money, what's in it for EMI?
Well, actually, I put that question to Robert Thompson at Syracuse University.
It's about getting this music available in ways that many people are now getting their music. I mean, I've got students that have never bought a CD in their entire life.
But it is about money for iTunes, right? Or is it?
Well, yes and no. Here's Robert Thompson again.
Not having the Beatles was always, of course, a kind of big symbolic gap as well as a financial one. It would be like the world's greatest bookstore, but you couldn't sell Shakespeare in it.
So, all right, everybody wins then?
Well, no, you know, never. Beatles cover bands were making a mint on iTunes, and they're probably not too happy that Beatles and iTunes have
come together right now.
One of my favorites, Marketplace, is Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. Stacey, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 16th. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics all around the world and how it affects us here in the United States.
European leaders this morning did a lot of talking about Ireland. Investors worry the country may require a debt bailout from other European nations. So we've been covering this story for the past week. It's probably going to keep coming up, and it kind of reminds us of the Greek debt crisis. But what's really going on in Ireland? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is here to walk us through. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Is Ireland any different than Greece?
Well, both countries are in a severe downturn, so their public finances are shot to pieces for the usual reasons, low tax revenues and higher public spending on unemployment pay, things like that. But there's a critical difference between the two. Greece is in trouble, really in trouble, because of a wildly irresponsible government living beyond its means, overspending on the Olympics, providing pensions and other benefits it couldn't afford, while in Ireland it was wildly irresponsible banks at the root of the problem. They inflated a massive property bubble, which has now burst. Simon Tilford is with the Centre for European Reform.
Now they have a huge overhang of unsold houses and a highly indebted banking sector and an economy that is unlikely to grow much for many years to come.
Because the Irish government feared that widespread bank defaults could bring down the whole economy, it guaranteed most of the bank debts. So now the Irish government is as heavily indebted as the Greek government.
All right, Stephen, but we keep hearing about more and more European countries with these debt problems. Where is this all going to lead?
Well, worst case scenario, the euro could break up. The country to watch as ever is Germany. The absolute bottom line, I believe, is will Germany be prepared to pick up the tab for the weaker member states that can't pay their way? That's the ultimate question. Will the Germans agree to pay more, a lot more, to keep the euro going?
All right. Marketplace is Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Well, Steve, as you know, Fiat's running things now at Chrysler.
Oh, yeah.
And part of the Italian carmaker's plans for the company is to revamp and reintroduce some of the old favorites, the Grand Caravan minivan and the Avenger sedan.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports the point is to get drivers excited about Chryslers again.
Some cars have redesigned interiors, while others sport new engines. The company even rechristened the struggling Sebring. It's now the 200 instead, playing off the success of Chrysler's sedan called the 300. Jesse Toprak is an analyst at TrueCar.com.
These are more or less stopgap measures, and I don't think necessarily this is going to cause a big flood to Chrysler dealerships.
But that's exactly what Chrysler needs right now. Marianne Keller is an independent industry analyst. She says a lot of Chrysler sales are to places like rental car companies that are updating their fleets.
For Chrysler to succeed, it cannot rely on fleet customers. That's a stagnant and static market. The growth has to come from a rebound in consumer spending.
There is hope for Chrysler, though. The new Jeep Cherokee has been selling well, and Fiat will introduce a whole new line of Italian vehicles next year. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, the bailout of the automakers came at the tail end of a whole string of bailouts sparked by the financial crisis a couple of years ago. The things that led to that financial crisis are the subject of a new book. It's called All the Devils Are Here, and it's by Joe Nocera of the New York Times and Bethany McLean of Vanity Fair. And she joins us now. Bethany McLean, welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start on June 29th, 2001, a dramatic point in your book. Josh Rosner, who was working at a research firm at the time, starts to discover that people are taking out a lot of subprime mortgages using smaller down payments, and he writes a paper called A Home Without Equity is Just a Rental with Debt, and he gets a call.
He gets a call from a man named Charles Kindleberger, and Charles is a famous guy in Wall Street lore. He wrote a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, and Josh doesn't realize who this is at first, and Josh thinks, okay, well, fine, I'll meet with him when I have time, and then Kindleberger says his name. And it's really this great moment because it shows you that people who understood bubbles recognized what was forming here as early as 2001.
And all along the way in the book, there are people that catch on to what's going on, and the warnings seem to go unheeded.
It's so often the story in our business world, particularly, where skeptics simply aren't valued, and that's certainly the case here.
Do you think it was regulators not paying attention to what was going on, or did they know what was happening and they just chose to ignore it?
I think regulators chose to ignore the crisis for a couple of reasons. One was this ideology that the market is always right. Secondly, the regulators were extremely susceptible to the arguments that the industry put forward. Derivatives are innovation. Innovation is good. We don't want to squelch innovation. Two, homeownership. Mm-hmm. We need to extend credit to people. We don't want to do anything to stop the flow of credit now, do we?
If the financial reform law that passed this year had been in place, could this whole thing have been avoided?
If the new Consumer Protection Agency had done its job and had seen that people were getting loans they couldn't pay back and said, we're going to stop this, then the tool, the mortgage, which was at the root of this financial crisis, that wouldn't have happened. But I guess what makes me a little bit worried about the future is that in many ways, this wasn't so much a failure of existing regulation as it was a failure of regulators to use the powers they had. I don't know how you argue that past won't be prologue.
The book is All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. It's by Joe Nocera of The New York Times and Bethany McLean, who's been talking to us this morning. Bethany McLean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Joe Nocera will talk to Kai Ryssdal about the book tonight on Marketplace. Also, our new book blog, The Big Book, launched this morning on Marketplace.org, and it's got interviews and reviews of all the latest books on business and economics. Now, Steve, you know the KFC Double Down sandwich?
Yes,
the one
yes.
that has fried chicken instead of bread buns?
Forget the carbs, give me straight fat? Yeah.
Straight fat. Well, here in the U.S., it's been very popular, but in Canada, it's actually the most successful item KFC has ever sold, until yesterday, that is, when the KFC Canadian division pulled the sandwich off the menu with no explanation.
Oh, wow.
Now, it looks like between this and the limited-time McRib sandwich at McDonald's, the latest trend in fast food marketing seems to be tough love. You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, November 16th. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
Well, today, every member of Congress will get a present from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's a new game called This Way to Jobs, a critique of federal rules and regulations. Marketplace's David Gura played along.
Here I am in the taxation zone among crumbling small businesses.
I get to spin.
I try to survive, moving my smiley face avatar along Main Street, USA.
One, two, passing panic pothole debt dip, gridlock's guideline.
James Gelfand at the Chamber of Commerce helped design the game.
It's not quite as fun as Candyland because being a business owner is pretty tough right now.
If I were a kid, I'd want to hang out with King Candy. Finally, I get a lucky spin.
I did it. All right. Congratulations on being a winner. You've navigated many complex and onerous regulations to make it to Prosperity Park.
Okay, I get that government stood in my way. Now that I'm rich, where's my candy? In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A new study in the current issue of the Journal of Marketing says brand names mean so much to consumers, they'll go to great lengths to afford them. Joe Priester is one of the authors of that study. He's associate professor of marketing at the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California. Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Steve.
I got to tell you, I love Frosted Flakes. I've eaten them since I was a kid. Why did I become enamored with that particular brand?
Well, my guess is that it's enmeshed with a lot of other experiences and memories. You not only like Frosted Flakes, but you sort of consider it a part of yourself, and you probably think about it unprompted.
I can remember when I was a poor college student and mom and dad didn't have the money to buy my Frosted Flakes anymore. And I saved a couple bucks by buying the generic brand.
And then when you had money again, did you stick with the generic?
I started buying the brand again.
Just like the thought of losing or not having our good friends around can sort of lead to this emotional distress, what's interesting is that brands can prompt exactly the same kind of thing.
What was your brand?
If I have a Starbucks in my hand in the morning, I sort of feel secure and I can take on the world.
Dating back a long time?
Oh, it reminds me back when I was in New York and I'd be walking to the subway in the snow and to have that Starbucks. It was sort of a nice memory in time.
I know it may sound like we've got the Kellogg's cereal company and Starbucks coffee company, and you know the representatives yeah. are right outside of the door. But I can tell you that this is pertinent information because these guys are taking a look at this information and saying, wait.
Well, in a way, this becomes the new target for businesses to really be exceptional and to really excel. It's not just how do I get them to like us, but what can we do to really provide something that makes it really meaningful and part of the person.
Today, there obviously is a lot of hardship, economic hardship, high unemployment, a lot of people cutting corners. Is that making any kind of difference?
That's when this brand attachment really becomes important. Because if times aren't tough and you have more resources, then you can be buying all sorts of brands. But when you start to having to cut back, I think that there's a differential in how you cut back. So it's the brands that you're really attached with. Those are the ones you'll try to hang on to as long as you can. Whereas the brands that you simply like, those are easy to substitute.
Joe Priester, Associate Professor of Marketing at USC's Marshall School of Business. Joe, thanks.
Hey, Steve, it's a pleasure.
And finally, a business professor at Harvard has taken to Hollywood to teach students about the difficulties of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, this guy, Noam Wasserman, he uses clips, Jeremy, of TV shows and movies like this one from the film Jerry Maguire. Remember Jerry Maguire?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, here's
Show Me
the
Money.
Yeah, Show Me the Money. This is right after Show Me the Money. After Maguire gets fired from his sports agent job, he asks other employees to come with him to start a new business.
If anybody else wants to come with me, this moment will be the moment of something real.
And Steve Wasserman also cites an old episode of Different Strokes where Arnold goes into the bug spray business with his stepmother.
Oh my God, that is a classic.
A classic.
Indeed. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Shelley Moulton produces this podcast. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.